Cicadas and crickets are singing for you. Nature is noisy. Politicians are too. I'm getting accustomed to things unloud, yet longing for being just a face in a crowd. Well, this is where the arts and culture of West Wisconsin congregates and communicates. Thanks for finding a place in the audience. I'm Al Ross, and this week, singer-songwriter John Smith shares his work and the process from his home in Trempealeau, where he's spending a lot of time. Good news is, he says he's writing a lot. Jim Oliver and Heather Rutledge of ArtReach St. Croix provide details about this year's unorthodox Big Read and Festival Theater's outdoor readings of Silent Sky. The book, the readings, the play, all timely and tantalizing. Catherine Thomas stops by with her guest, Scott Dyer, an Aliva Strum educator who also enjoys playing the mountain dulcimer. You'll leave this week's program knowing a bunch more about it. And this episode of Spectrum West begins right here. Eau Claire has a public arts council. Not surprising, given the amount and quality of what's produced in this river valley of ours. The president of that council is Jo Ellen Burke, herself responsible for some of that art. And with sidekick Terry Meyer, proprietor of 200 Main Gallery, she has taught others and is simply one of those whose shoulders to the wheel, keeping it going strong even during the worst of times. Most of the burners on the Public Arts Council stove are hot. Let's first define the Public Arts Council. If we dissect it, Public Arts Council. What else can you tell us about it other than that it's public, deals in the arts, and is a council?
Or a committee. Down,
maybe the history of it. I visited the Facebook page. And I see that maybe it got its legs in 2017. Is that right?
That's right. In 2017, it really was a city-initiated venture, started through Leadership Eau Claire, did enormous research, and put together a format for the Arts Council based on the request from the city and Dale Peters. And then they formed a board. The board worked hard at establishing what the role would be and what Eau Claire needs. And as it evolved over the course of the years, as with most things, funding was an issue and time was an issue. So as it evolved, they did some terrific things in terms of a few pieces and one large, really notable piece that is actually coming within 1 month from San Francisco. At the time, I was on the board and ended up being the only member left. I hope that's not personal. But what evolved was Mike Szabo's sculpture. That piece was something initiated by the Arts Council and provided the funding from the city. A real feather in the cap of the previous council. The new council, since I'd say December, is a dynamic group of people, and we looked through everything else that we had had with great respect for the work that was done. We redid some of our mission. We've done some strategic planning, and we've initiated some projects. I would say in rewriting our mission, people can kind of fall asleep when they think about mission statements, but we took it very seriously. And we believe that it gives us the foundation for what we're doing. Basically, to summarize, we work to improve cultural access to the visibility of art. So we try to focus on the power of public art in inspiring social and personal change. We want to be liaisons between artists, residents, civic leaders, and local businesses. And we just believe through powerful, culturally attuned, and aesthetically stimulating artistic manifestations, if we can use the word, we're committed to changing lives of people and hoping to affect our neighborhoods and community and people themselves.
I'm sure you're in the process of doing that. This sculpture coming from the Bay Area, what is it? Where is it going? Or is it under wraps?
It's under wraps in the sense that it isn't here yet. It hasn't been publicly displayed or shared yet. It's called Eddies. It's a piece that was an incredible process, really, of a great jury of an outreach that went across the country. We tried to make sure we covered all areas in terms of what our community wants, aesthetically what we think would be appropriate at Haymarket Plaza. So that's where it's going to be. The process had a lot of integrity to it, and the choice, we think, was really stellar. And we plan to do a reveal September 18th.
Cool. Is this in honor of some guy named Eddie, or does it have to do with water?
It's more attuned to the waters. He did keep in mind what the confluence is, what it means to Eau Claire. the Eddies, he will have a statement with that as well. I hope to talk to you again about that, or have you talk to Mike Sable.
Joellen Burke on the phone with us, proprietor of 200 Main Gallery and Wine, herself an artist, teacher as well, and she's also, on, as you know from last week's show, on the faculty of the Midwest Artist Academy. Do you have time for doing anything else? No, you don't. She's also president of the Eau Claire Public Arts Council, or ECPAC. I love saying that. As soon as I saw it, I went, ECPAC.
Oh, you have such a way with words.
Yeah. The big news is you've received a rather sizable grant, seven large, as they say, or $7,000, from Arts Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Economic Development Council. Is this a grant you had to apply for, or was it just bestowed on you, or what?
It was bestowed upon us. So with real gratitude for this, we were selected as one of up to 10 communities in the state given the chance to work on this. I think it came from knowledge on the part of Arts Wisconsin. Mm. Ann Katz, we're so grateful for her involvement with us. She's given us a lot of assistance as we've developed as a new council. Mm-hmm. So she's been very aware of what we've been trying to do. And as they were selecting different communities, we were one of those because it seemed to fit with what they're looking at in terms of artists. They really want to connect with artists and support artists who have been out of work. They're calling it short-term big investment for the mini New Deal for individuals, businesses, and communities, ultimately meaning they are sympathetic to artists whose income have been cut, slashed, or eliminated.
Sure. Mm-hmm. You brought up Ann Katz. They have the right person, I think, at the helm.
Just a passionate advocate. And she's so aware of what we're doing. I don't know how she does it, her hands in everything across the state, and brings a real awareness to the power of art.
You are going to solicit participation. And I believe that artists in Dunn, Eau Claire, and Chippewa counties can participate. Mm-hmm. You are looking for a certain piece of art or pieces, if that applies in the end. What are you looking for from artists?
We've got a theme, and we've decided as a board we wanted to really address some issues. So we've called this theme Connecting Our Community with Compassion and Conversation. How we can connect with each other. How do we consider and address the disconnect between our various communities, socioeconomic, minority, disenfranchised groups? What we can do through that is to bring people together, hopefully, through two-dimensional art, three-dimensional art. We want a piece that would reflect an understanding of civic engagement, the importance of addressing inclusion, collaboration. Okay. So we're looking for a piece or pieces that can be placed in neighborhoods, in different areas, in spaces that are public, just to address that issue. You know, we have discussed as a board, there's a real passion for making sure that we connect people to have conversations, because this is a time. The state of our world right now makes it an important time to go beyond the typical or what we might have been satisfied with in the past as far as art.
I went to the site at which artists can make a submission. Some of the factors that the art must accomplish: it must reflect an understanding of civic engagement, address inclusion, collaboration, and communication. There you are with the alliteration. Right. It'll be outdoor and in a public area.
We really want to be thoughtful about what this means, where it would fit in our community, how we can engage people in a conversation around this piece.
As a council, you have no preconceived notions what this might look like. It's going to be a surprise.
No.
And the other thing is, are you looking at submissions as they come in, or is this all going to be one big thing at the end?
We try to be as transparent and open as a board. So when we receive an application, it goes into our public drives. We'll be looking as they come in. They're not based on time of placement either. Our deadline is August 28th at 9 p.m. If we get a submission at 8:30, they're just as qualified as others.
This is the kind of stuff that a council like this should be good at and do on a regular basis. You agree with that?
Absolutely. You know, I've been on so many boards, simply because of my age probably, but so many boards can be productive, can be very active, others might serve in other capacities, but I really haven't worked with a board as passionate and active as this one, and I think it stems from a deep desire and respect for more art and art to have an effect, especially during a time like this. As I was prepared to talk to you, and you know how nervous I get to talk to you, Al.
Mm-hmm. I'm nervous to talk to you.
I looked up a few things that describe what really making art is, and just to see these things that inspire. And one of them says that making art is essential to speaking truth to power, to dream new realities, and to ultimately change the world, because artists are explorers, healers, activists, and visionaries. At this time, art can really heal us, it can help us get through things, and it can inspire and stimulate change, too.
How do you handle and how do you accept public input?
That's a good question. Just as COVID hit, we wanted to have public discussion sessions. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to do that again. We'll probably do it virtual. But to have public discussion is really at the heart of some of our strategic planning.
It's called the Eau Claire Public Arts Council. Jo Ellen Burke, our guest, thank you so much for being with us. How soon are we going to know?
We make the announcement by September 4th. We'll make sure everybody hears about it through all media.
Because you have a Facebook page, and there was a video on it when you decided to incorporate. Are you going to do a video of the announcement?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for the idea, Al. I think we will. And
oh, cool.
I just should mention, too, we just received our 501c3 status, so we are a nonprofit.
Gee, that means we can donate.
That's correct.
I'll bet you're glad you snuck that part in.
Very much so.
Thank you, Joe.
Well, thanks, Al. Thanks so much.
Down the road on Spectrum West, John Smith on writing those marvelous songs he sings with friends. Jim Oliver takes us to the banks of the St. Croix River for events of the Big Read 2020 style. And coming up next, Catherine Thomas digs the dulcimer. Support for WPR comes from Western Wisconsin Health in Baldwin, offering robotic-assisted surgical procedures and post-surgery recovery rooms with natural sunlight and prairie views. Details are at www.health.org. You know, she may be young, but Catherine Thomas is an old soul when it comes to music preferences. I don't know the innermost details, but she appears to forego, at least periodically, the music of her generation for classic country and music of the woods and hills, like banjo, and her newest flame, the mountain dulcimer. Did someone say mountain dulcimer? We did say Milton Dulcimer. You're listening to one. Here's Catherine Thomas and guest Scott Dyer.
The first time that I saw a Mountain Dulcimer in action was when I watched the video of you playing it for the 4th of July celebration through the Chippewa Valley Museum this year. And I'm guessing I may not be the only person who is not familiar with the Mountain Dulcimer.
A Mountain Dulcimer is a lap instrument. It's similar to a zither. They can be shaped in a variety of shapes, trapezoids, boxes even. You think of it kind of like a box, about 2-3 inches deep and about 3, maybe even 4 feet long, with a fretboard running along the top. It has between 3 to 4 strings. Mine, I typically have 3 strings. What they're supposed to sound like is kind of like a bagpipe. You have one bass string, and then you have kind of a drone string, and then 2 melody strings that you play.
I guess I wouldn't have thought of bagpipes, but with the drone string, I suppose that could do it.
Yep. The name is an adapted Greek name, dulce, like sweet, and then summer. I'm not sure exactly where that came from. It's supposed to be kind of like a sweet-sounding instrument is what it is. And it really is an Appalachian-based instrument, and that's probably why you and not too many other people around here have seen them. They're much more common as you get into Appalachia, West Virginia, and even down into the Ozarks.
I was watching you play it in that video, and the way that you make the melody notes, it looks like your fingers were just walking across the fretboard.
There is a little bit of that. I started playing the piano when I was a kid, and I think the two intertwine somewhat. You kind of keep your fingers on the string as much as possible and push down between the frets, these metal frets. Not on them, otherwise you'll get a twang.
Yeah, well, the piano, that's pretty common. How did you get into the mountain dulcimer?
Back many years ago when I was a kid, I built one from a kit that I picked up at Silver Dollar City Amusement Park. I built that for my mother. I ended up playing it more than she did, but she wanted to hang on to it. So when I went to college, my parents got me another kit, which I also then built. That's the one I'm playing on now. And then I'm working on a courting dulcimer for my daughter, which has two fretboards and work in opposite directions. And the history of that one is that when you'd have a gentleman suitor that wanted to date your daughter, and this is not my intention, but they'd come over and you could leave them alone in a room, and as long as you heard harmony and melody being played, then everything was great.
Wow, kind of a chaperone without having to have a chaperone in the room.
Yeah, and you get to enjoy some music too.
Yeah, great. Multiple benefits there. Now, I had also heard about the hammered dulcimer, and I looked that up, and for anyone who's familiar with the hammered dulcimer, mountain dulcimer, not like that.
Exactly. No, I think the name is all that they really share. Like, I am not one to play the hammer dulcimer. I've tried it a couple of times. It's a beautiful instrument. It's a percussion instrument, really, because you're obviously using a hammer to strike strings, whereas with a mountain dulcimer, you're plucking it with a pick. Occasionally, if you don't have a pick, you know, a soft stick or a bird feather actually works pretty well, too.
Wow. Well, you can play all kinds of music on a mountain dulcimer, and you have quite a range of songs, including some songs about the Midwestern lumber industry booming here in the 19th century. But as you said, it's called the mountain or the Appalachian dulcimer, and we are in Wisconsin. Did the mountain dulcimer migrate to lumber camps in our area?
Well, that's a great question, and I'd have to say I don't have evidence to support it. They were pretty widespread and traveled, and I do know that they were around, but I can't find a lot of evidence of that. That doesn't stop me from playing it there. It's a really tough little instrument, too. As I should mention, just from the basic construction, I carry it around in a canvas bag. And I've carried it all over the country, done camping with it, and so I could see it working pretty well in a lumber camp setting.
Yeah, it's simple and sturdy.
Yep.
What instruments would they play in a lumber camp if they weren't playing the mountain dulcimer?
The obvious answer there is the fiddle. Fiddle's really, really common. Again, a pretty durable instrument, small, compact. Got to remember, these guys are walking into these camps. They're not getting rides on trains or anything like that, typically. Harmonicas would be also very compact. A jaw harp, a metal instrument you hold up to your teeth and twang on it, that would be pretty common. Spoons, any sort of folk instrument you could think of that would be compact and durable and that you wouldn't mind walking a little ways with, that's what you'd find up there.
We'll talk about a specific lumber song you play in just a little bit, the Sawdust War Ballad of 1881. More generally, what kinds of songs did lumberjacks play?
It wouldn't be very common that you'd hear them up there. It would just be typically on Saturday night because lumber camp buildings, the bunkhouse, would really just be used for sleeping, waking up in the dark, coming back in the dark, just exhausted. Saturday night, you could stay up a little later, have fun, because Sunday you wouldn't need to go out and chop wood. You're one day off. And so the types of songs that you would hear up there would be kind of ways of bringing people together. There's a lot of people from different countries. The joke is that it was hard to get a good night's sleep because everybody's snoring in different languages.
Mm-hmm.
Norwegian, Swedes, Irish, you name it. There's going to be a lot of different ethnicities and languages out there. So music would be one way to bring people together. Some of the songs that I played that I know would be playing there would be like Barbara Allen, I believe an Irish folk tune. And by the way, the Scotch and the Irish claim the dulcimer as their own.
Mm.
And otherwise, just songs that you could dance to anything that you could have, just have some fun and stomp your feet to would be something you'd probably hear there.
Now, speaking of dancing, lumber camps, they were all men.
That's correct.
So I remember from that video that I saw for the 4th of July celebration that you told a story about dancing and women, or the lack of women.
So the way that they would work that, and this is actually pretty common, you'd have to have one person in these dances to dance one part, and the male part, and one to dance the female part, because they were slightly different. So one of these guys would sometimes tie a white handkerchief around his arm, and then that would signify that you're dancing the woman's part, and you'd switch off. I don't think there was anything ever malicious by it, maybe not even any teasing, because it was all in good-natured fun.
We're talking with Scott Dyer about the mountain dulcimer and lumber camp music in Wisconsin. Scott teaches social studies in the Oliva Strum School District, and he was featured this year in the Chippewa Valley Museum's 4th of July virtual celebration with the backdrop of the Wisconsin Logging Museum in Eau Claire's Carson Park. Well, the lumber business has a lot of different aspects to it, and I think maybe the general idea of it is being out there in the woods, cutting down trees, but that was only one part of a much larger industry. So let's get to that song that I mentioned earlier, Sawdust War Ballad of 1881. Tell us about that song and its historical significance for our region.
It does have some historical significance here. Like you said, there were a lot of different facets to the industry of logging. Obviously, you've got the people cutting down the trees in the woods, people then that are going to drive these logs along the river, river pigs they'd sometimes call them. Then once you get to the mills, you've got, you know, an army of people that are going to be working in the mills in Eau Claire, Menominee, Rice Lake, turning these logs into lumber. And then, of course, you've got people that are shipping it out and so on. In Eau Claire in 1881, there was a mill strike. Men were bound and determined to get a 10-hour work day. They were working 12, 6 days a week, with the exception of Sundays, and it would be 12 hours on and 12 hours off. And that was pretty common for the mills because they said that they needed to work these guys 12 hours a day because they only had a certain window during the summer. They went on strike. The mill workers, that is, struck at the Eau Claire Lumber Company on July 18th, 1881, went around the town, shut down the mills, some reports of force being used, and then they met in what would be now known as Randall Park. It was known as Westside Park then, and basically had meetings, elected leaders, basically just pushing for that 10-hour workday. And it's interesting that there's so many other things that you could probably complain about in that job, the danger, the idea that they're using company bills. They weren't paid in cash. You'd have to go and buy your things from a company store. But it was the hours they were really after. Unfortunately, the strike didn't work, and that's where the song comes in. The mill owners quickly rallied, sent a letter to the governor, Governor Smith at the time. They sent up National Guard troops, militia National Guard. It was kind of in a transition period there. The National Guard camped right at Randall Park, kind of breaking up the rallies, and then a couple of the ringleaders of the strike were arrested. Perhaps on trumped-up charges, there were maybe some realities to the riotous charges they were causing. And then the mills opened. There was such a abundance of labor, unskilled labor, that was available at that time that the mills opened in about 2 weeks underneath that same 12-hour workday. And then the song that I sing was written allegedly, I believe, by some men that were in the Company G of the Lake City Guards, and that would be a unit that was from Madison that got dispatched up to Eau Claire. And it's a mocking tune. It's kind of mocking, saying, oh, yeah, you know, this Sawdust War was so tough. It was such a hard-fought battle. There were no shots fired between the strikers and the militia. And, in fact, the National Guard had a party at the end of their stay here that was thrown by some of the strikers in order to bail out their strike leaders that were in the jail here in town.
Oh, I'm a Lake City Guard, sir. I belong to Company C of the gallant 4th Battalion of Wisconsin National G. On glory I was bent, sir, for fighting I did pant. So to Eau Claire I went, sir, the strikers to supplant. Well, it's well, sir, it's good, sir, never been known to lie. And if you'd been to Eau Claire, you'd see the same as I. My buttons, they were right, sir, and loaded 20 rounds. My belt was far from light, sir, as I slept to martial sounds. The strikers we did meet, sir, on the banks of the Eau Claire. We fought them long and well, sir, despite our villainous fare. Well, it's well, sir, it's true, sir, never did seem to lie. And if you'd been to Eau Claire, you'd say the same as I. The Sawdust campaign is over, sir, the riders are all foiled, and we've been ordered home, sir, with our uniforms all soiled. Oh, war, sir, it's most cruel, sir, especially a sawmill scare, but we're always ready, sir, to go again to Eau Claire. Oh, it's well, sir, it's true, sir, never did see to lie, and if you'd been to Eau Claire, you'd say the same as I.
Well, you are a history and social studies teacher.
Yep.
Do you ever take your Mountain Dulcimer into your classroom? And if you do, what do your students make of it?
Yeah, I have a couple of times when I have done some Civil War lock-ins. I have a history club. Well, we do, you know, activities related to the American Civil War and learning some Civil War history. And part of that is learning songs from that. And so I will play them on the dulcimer, and the students really like them. And you know, in fact, in some schools around the country, it's a shop project. To build a dulcimer, combining music and history and some industrial arts as well. And the kids like it. They typically like it when I play at the, well, I guess it's the Wisconsin Logging Museum now, but it used to be Paul Bunyan Logging Camp. When I play there in the fourth, you know, kids, they'll sit and watch it for a long time. Like you said, it's not a real commonly seen instrument, so I think it intrigues people.
Now, I'm hoping we can get like a dulcimer club going or something. That'd be really great. I play banjo.
Oh,
and
nice.
Mountain dulcimer, just as attractive, I think, as a banjo. But
I think Menominee used to have one. I seem to remember 5, maybe 10 years ago, people would get together at the Menominee Public Library and they would play their dulcimers.
Ugh, great. We have to bring that back when it's safe to do so.
Yeah.
What is the value of playing traditional music now on a traditional instrument, too? Why do you keep doing that?
Well, I do it because it's fun, and it's a great way to learn history. When I recorded the Sawdust War Ballad, you know, that's a song that you wouldn't have heard ever anywhere, that sort of thing. And I think it's a great way of connecting back with the past. I do some living history events. In fact, I was just on the Chippewa River doing one, canoeing from Eau Claire to Durand, just to get a feeling of what people had experienced. It kind of inspires you that whatever sort of difficult times you face now, that know that people also faced difficult times and they worked their way through it. So I think playing music is another way of kind of getting into people's mindset about what they were thinking and feeling. I think it can be a nice personal lesson, and just is also an interesting one to learn about their local history.
Scott Dyer plays the mountain dulcimer and teaches social studies in the Oliva Strum School District. You can find a video of him on YouTube playing music and telling lumber camp stories at the Wisconsin Logging Museum in Eau Claire's Carson Park. Hopefully we can see him next year in person there at that celebration. His name, Dyer, that's D-Y-A-R, if you're wondering how to spell that. Scott, thanks so much for your time and for the music.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. More music with homebound songwriter John Smith. Yet to come this week. Jim Oliver's here with yet another example of how theater and artistic organizations are making the most of a situation no one expected, but everyone accepted, using talents to create ways to keep art alive in themselves and to satisfy a hankering during hunkering for people all over Wisconsin. Here's Jim.
Silent Sky, the true story of 19th century astronomer Henrietta Leavitt, is a play written by Lauren Gunderson. An outdoor reading version of the play is being produced by the Festival Theater of St. Croix Falls in conjunction with ArtReach St. Croix and their annual Big Read. Productions are scheduled for August 28th at the Art Barn in Osceola, August 29th in the Zephyr Theater in Stillwater, and August 30th in Bellwin Conservancy in Afton. Joining us by telephone from her ArtReach office in Stillwater is Executive Director Heather Rutledge. Thanks so much for coming on and talking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start off just asking about the Big Read and how it's different from previous years, which is a rather obvious question, I guess.
Yeah, it seems like an obvious question. However, when it came to the pandemic and really shut down the Big Read for the programs that we had planned for April. So this year's Big Read is our sixth in the St. Croix Valley, and NEA Big Read is supported with funds from the National Endowment for the Arts. So it's a very big, prestigious grant to secure for the St. Croix Valley, and only 75 other communities in the nation are selected to have Big Read programs. So I think it's a pretty big deal. We really start planning a year and a half out. Then we do a lot of promotions and getting everything pinned down early in the calendar year. So in January, we were hitting everything really hard, encouraging people to read Lab Girl by Minnesota author Hope Jaron, and encouraging people to get these April events on their calendars. That came after over 12 months of planning and work. And so with the pandemic, I mean, the first obvious thing that happened is everything just was canceled or postponed. You know, we moved pretty quickly to move the gallery exhibition and to talk to Festival Theater about what other options were available for Silent Sky. Silent Sky was originally to be a fully staged production in their black box in St. Croix Falls. The pandemic changed Silent Sky from a production to a staged reading, but that also provided the opportunity to take the show on the road and take that staged reading to a couple of different St. Croix Valley communities.
Usually the big read involved reading books. How does that fit this year?
Yes, the big read is based on a common book each year. As I mentioned, this year is Lab Girl. In previous years, we did Grapes of Wrath, Into the Beautiful North. We did Maltese Falcon. So we've always had very different titles with very different themes running through the book. We have always partnered with St. Croix Festival Theater to produce a play that ties into the book either directly with the production of Grapes of Wrath, which was amazing, or indirectly through another story that has some of the common themes from the book. Everything is based in the book, but then we use the arts, visual arts, theater, music, whatever other outlets that are relevant to the theme to sort of bring the book to life and to connect people to reading for pleasure, reading great literature, and hearing these great stories. It's a pretty interesting way to go about a book club, a very different and more dynamic way to get people involved with literature.
She is Heather Rutledge, Executive Director of ArtReach St. Croix. Tell us about Silent Sky.
Silent Sky was, as you mentioned, written by Lauren Gunderson, who's a prolific award-winning playwright. It's a true story of a woman astronomer who worked at Harvard Observatory in the early 1900s. She had a lot of trouble, as many women scientists did and still do, to have her ideas taken seriously. And yet her contributions to astronomy have been long-lasting and are now being acknowledged. She did a lot of calculations about the distance of stars by measuring light. That is the basis for Silent Sky, and then the story goes from there and talks about complications of being a woman in science, both professionally and also personal choices that need to be made. So it is fictionalized, but based on Henrietta Leavitt's story.
Talk a little bit about the venues.
We want to take advantage of the great outdoors along the St. Croix Valley. We've partnered with the Art Barn in Osceola for the opening night in the Pine Grove behind the Art Barn. The next night, Saturday the 29th, we'll bring it to Zephyr Theater in Stillwater. They have built an outdoor stage doing live music and theater, social distancing, and breezes to dissipate the virus and make enjoying the arts safe. And then finally, Bellman Conservancy, because they have an observatory and they have a partnership with the Astronomical Society. That was the purpose behind selecting Bellman, but they also have a Pine Grove. All these outdoor venues provide different opportunities, but also let Festival Theater and the Big Read of the St. Croix Valley like reach out to different communities.
The shows are free of charge, but there's a suggested donation to help a variety of things, I guess.
You know, when the show would have been fully staged production, there would have been a ticket price. When we moved it to a staged reading and took the show on the road, Festival Theater and ArtReach agreed a suggested donation would be a great way to go. It allows people to pay what they can. We do suggest $10 per person. Then people can pick. We're selling the tickets by groupings rather than by individuals. you purchase your group. That way, related people can hang out together, and that helps us decide how many people can be at each show. And I just will mention that the suggested donations, those proceeds go directly to Festival Theater.
That sounds good. Well, we've been talking to Heather Rutledge, the executive director of ArtReach St. Croix, talking about Silent Sky, the true story of 19th century astronomer Henrietta Leavitt. The play will run at three different venues, August 28th at the Art Barn in Osceola, August 29th at the Zephyr Theater in Stillwater, and August 30th at Belwin Conservancy in Afton. Heather, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for your support of Festival Theater.
And thank you so much, Jim Oliver. So nice to have correspondents like Jim and Catherine. Wow. Put my feet up once in a while. John Smith is one of my favorite song spinners. He writes stories and then puts them to music as few can. Coming up next on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Charter Bank, a locally owned community bank now offering checking account options. Charter Bank is dedicated to being invested in the community, customers, and employees. More information is at charterbank.bank. Well, John Smith has a name that's unpretentious, and his persona is unassuming, but his music makes up for any notion that his talent is as regular as his signature.
Just the other morning, going through a drawer, I stumbled on a photo, maybe 1974. It was me and my older brother back at the old home place, sitting around the kitchen table, looking face to face. A couple of hippies in our 20s, flannel shirts and bushy beards. You can see the bond between us, and I still feel it's there. Yeah, he's always been a hero, someone I've looked up to. Now here I sit, an older man, and I still feel that's true. Oh, when I'm feeling low, somehow I swear he knows. That's when he calls, just to say hello. Oh, that's the way it is between me and him. That's my friend, that's my big brother Jim.
This is the songwriter's songwriter, and nothing I can say will do justice to that label. You just have to hear him sing his songs like that one. Like other musicians, the last 6 months have seen none of that in front of live audiences, and electronically just a handful of times from home. Home, or Trempealeau, Wisconsin, is where we caught him for a phone conversation, and we began with a memory of his.
To the Air Force, me, I headed west.
I remember I taught a songwriting class in California. We did a really interesting exercise. You know, you really push people when you have them for a month long to, you know, kind of write deeper stuff. And anyway, we did an exercise about death, you know, because everything tells us that's the number one fear that people have. Anyway, the exercise basically was, had a partner and, you know, you read these old Buddhist things about death to each other, and eventually you journaled about your own death, and then eventually you wrote your own eulogy. And anyway, the class is always kind of mixed. There's a lot of young folks. They're just, like, a lot of young people now, they change careers like six or seven times. Well, it'd be the far spectrum of that, you know, people that just have the opportunity to say, what's next in my life? And then there are a number of people that are retired, that have worked their jobs, and now they're just looking for experience. And so they're like, I'm going to go take this workshop for a month,
sure,
kind of a thing. And so anyway, the older people, man, they just dove in and relished the death thing. Not like they relished it, but like they got it, and they just went for it, and it scared the crap out of young folks.
Ah.
Some of them couldn't do it. They did write songs about it, and some of them were kind of brilliant, but they couldn't really do the exercise as it's planned. It just scared him too much. And it was just like denial. Like, I am not going there. Nobody's going to make me go there. I can't go there.
It's too far off, they say.
But you're right, though. This thing here, is we should be humbled. And I know it sure humbled me. And I'm just kind of looking at the pulse of people. And anybody to say this doesn't affect them, at least some low level of stress in your life. But, you know, some people are in denial about that.
Yeah. I want to establish with our audience a cool factor about you. You have a VW camper.
I do.
And the only thing I can think that would be better would be that inside it smells like patchouli.
I can work on that one.
Let me hear the pride in your voice as you tell us about the Volkswagen bus.
Yeah, they're kind of iconic, aren't they?
Yeah.
We've had a few different vans over the years. We had an old Volkswagen back in the 70s version when our kids were little. And, you know, took it over mountains and blew out cylinders and got them fixed and really enjoyed that. And then we kind of went to Toyota vans and stuff like that and just make a bed in the back for the kids. And,
sure.
And then now that the kids are gone, Joe and I, you know, went on the market and kind of kept our eyes out for a Volkswagen Euro van camper. And we found one a couple of years ago. I was out in California and I said, you know, driving down the interstates and I'm like, man, there's a lot of people out here. It must be one of these Volkswagen. So, yeah, so we got one. It's 2002 and it's in really good shape. Yeah, so we drove it back across the country down to the southwest, to Colorado and Utah and stuff. As a matter of fact, we're planning a trip next month to go just out west. We don't have anything kind of planned exactly, but it's a sense of freedom.
So now our audience knows just how cool you are. I've spoken with a lot of musicians since we applied the brakes back in March. Tell me what you've been doing. I mean, I know that you just did a Facebook Live concert from home. You and guitar buddy Dan Sobranek continue to hang out. And you actually live in a place with a view that I'll bet kind of inspires the writing of songs. Something you've been doing?
Yeah, I haven't been in the writing mode. It's not like I'm producing a ton of songs, but I got a lot of songs going. And I've been co-writing again, which is something I haven't done. A lot of my co-writing experience for years was when I had a Nashville songwriting deal, when you actually sat across the table. But now with Zoom and, you know, and just how comfortable we all are with texting, emails, and so forth, you can really fire stuff back and forth. But I do have several new songs that I've written by myself during the COVID time. Some of them have been kind of humorous. The first one I wrote, it was a song called Hunkered Love. You know, just about how, when it was still a little bit novel to be home a whole month day, barely going out for anything, you know, taking turns going to the grocery store. And I really have taken this time myself out to do a lot of more inner work, personal, spiritual awareness kind of stuff, I guess. You know, I'm used to being gone 50% of the time. I'm away on the road to Ireland, Scotland, every state in the country, and I teach workshops and, like I said, festivals. I lead musical grafting trips. So I'm gone a lot. So to be home this much, well, you know, half the time I'm gone, I'm really out there in the world. So then when I come home to the other half thing, I always looked at home as a place I just recharge my batteries. Because I used to think, well, I don't know what it'll be like to be home all the time. You know, maybe I'll go crazy in a little town like Trempealeau, like this is my world now. But I have it, and maybe it's because I've, you know, really worked at journaling, meditating every day. And, as you mentioned, the view, just really being in the present moment a little bit more of where I live, this place. And like, right now there's an Oreo sitting there eating the jelly, and rubber birds in the bird bath, a little wren on a chair right here. The river's right there, the wind is blowing nice from the east. Just noticing more, growing gardens, watching every day how the kale grows and stuff like that.
Those things could add kind of a new little fresh dimension to your songwriting.
Yeah, and if you notice, anybody who knows my stuff, I have my share of poeticness in my songs. And when you're doing poetry and songs, you use metaphor a lot. And I like metaphor that has to do with nature, with cycles and seasons and birds and flowers and rivers and stuff like that. So yeah, it's a little bit louder than usual.
Okay.
As you mentioned, I've done 4 or 5 of these Facebook Live concerts from my deck with the view out back with Dan Zabonik, and it's something. It really feeds my soul.
John Smith on the phone with us. He's a singer-songwriter, very good at it, lives in Trempealeau, and we've already listened to some of his music, and we're going to hear a little bit more. We've already kind of alluded to this, John. You're kind of well-known for writing melodic acoustic songs that tell stories and transport us to the place you were when you wrote it, maybe a physical or a mental place. Or some songs invite us to witness the life episode that you're writing about. Do you write music to maintain a reputation as that kind of a songwriter, or you just go off on tangents and surprise yourself sometimes?
It's a good question. You kind of want to be cautious about it. You don't want to always be kind of coming from the same place. You want to stretch your kind of wings a little bit. But yeah, you do get kind of known for writing a certain type of song. I'm about to co-write with somebody now, and I'm just thinking about how we're going to approach this. I've written a lot of songs about what's real close to my life. I'm very autobiographical. I'll tell a story about my mom dying, or I'll tell a story about my grandson going off to college. But there's times when I will kind of be in the middle of a song, and then I will kind of look at myself and say, am I being too much usual John Smith here, or can I go a different, should I go a little different direction? But at the same time, reverting to what you do well usually works.
Sure. Yeah, sure. If it ain't broke, don't break it.
Yeah, kind of.
During one of your visits to the Big River radio wave, you sang a song about your dad, and you had to stop because you were a bit overcome by emotion. I remember that distinctly. But you picked it and yourself up, and you did the song. I'm giggling because I remember you had a great story about what someone said at a show in Ireland, possibly right after that song. Do you remember that?
Yeah, it's called From His Window. Yeah, yeah, good memory, Al. Yeah, and my dad suffered from Alzheimer's. This ties in really well with what you asked about my style of writing songs. This was probably one of the first songs that I really wrote that people just said, well, nobody else could write that but you. And it's a song about him in a nursing home. And I wrote the song thinking it was so personal, I'll never sing it. And then I decided to pull it out at a show just to see what it felt like. And the response was pretty major and still one of the more popular songs I've ever written. And so I remember the very first time I was singing in Ireland. And it's a very sad song about my dad in a nursing home. He wouldn't know who you were half the time, but he always had a habit, even before he had Alzheimer's, of going to the window when you left and just being in the window waving at you down the street so you couldn't see him anymore. So one particular day that I wrote the song, I was saying goodbye. I said goodbye to him in the nursing home, went out in my car and looked up, and there he was waving. And it was especially a tearful kind of experience that particular day. I was just crushed me a little bit and wrote the song. Anyway, I decided what to sing in Ireland and thought, well, Irish people are pretty big-hearted and they're big in the family, and I'll sing this song about my dad. And geez, I sang the song. I think everybody in the room was crying, and I'm just fighting really hard to get through the song. When I see somebody else cry, I gotta like not look at them because it makes me want to well up, you know, and that doesn't serve the song very well. So I just like get through the song, and everybody in the audience is pulling out their hankies and sniffing nose and stuff. And this was my very first time playing in Ireland. I was like shocked, like, wow, some big-hearted crybabies here. But I was frozen. I just didn't know what to say. I just couldn't speak for a second. And of course, in Ireland, pretty much every gig, there's a bar somewhere in the room. Yep. And in the back, there was a little bar in the back. Some guys back there with the Guinness. And you know, there's like 100 people in the room, and he yells all the way from the back, so John, he says, could you sing a sad one now? It was perfect because the Irish, they're very funny and they're very quick, and everybody in the room roared and laughed. And I was like so thankful for that guy, like, okay, wow, maybe we can move on to something not so sad. But, you know, when people cry and stuff like that at songs, it's a good thing. It's usually tears of love and memory and remembrance and stuff like that. It comes from a place, and most of us are very guarded with our tears. We don't cry a lot, even when we go to the movies, you know. We don't want the person next to us seeing us crying at the movie. But I'm not afraid to go there, and I do in my songwriting quite a bit.
Cool.
It's just the way it is.
Always a pleasure talking with you, John. Thanks for being with us, and thanks for all the great music.
Yeah, Alan, thank you for putting on programs like this. All of us independent singer-songwriter folkies appreciate the community that you're part of and creating and stuff like that. So thanks, Al.
What a guy. Fun interview. And we'll have more John Smith music coming up in a moment. Want to tell you that you can go to Facebook / John Smith Music. He also has a website. Coming up next week on Spectrum West, he knows more about words, phrases, origins, and the English language than most anyone. He's been a WPR favorite for years, and he's back with a couple new books, plus intelligent answers to penetrating questions. Richard Lederer joins us from his home in California, and of course, a lot more. Thanks to Dean, Kate, Catherine, and Jim. Live smart, be safe. Let's get together again next week. And now a little more John Smith.
I met you in November. We took a walk down Cumming Street by that tiny place with the picket fence and great big ginkgo tree. You said growing up you had one too, stood tall in your backyard. I placed a leaf in my pocket and pressed it close to my heart. Ginkgo leaves may fall tomorrow on the frosty morning grass. Only God knows just how many autumn seasons we have left. So if some mighty wind come takes me and lays me softly on the ground, and I missed the last chance to say I love you, that's why I'm telling you now. I made a wish that day upon that leaf that you could find a way to let me into your heart and love me true one day. Well, that wish came true, and we planted a ginkgo all those years ago. Now it stands tall in the morning sun, all shimmering gold. Ginkgo leaves may fall tomorrow on the frosty morning grass. Only God knows just how many autumn seasons we have left. So if some mighty wind come takes me and lays me softly on the ground, and I missed the last chance to say I love you, that's why I'm telling you now. I'm telling you now. I'm telling you here. I'm the breeze that whispers through the